This is Audible.
Audible Frontiers presents Wild Seed, written by Octavia E. Butler and narrated by Dion Graham.
Book 1, Covenant, 1690. Chapter 1. Doro discovered the woman by accident when he went to see what was left of one of his seed villages. The village was a comfortable, mud-walled place, surrounded by grasslands and scattered trees. But Doro realized even before he reached it that its people were gone. Slavers had been to it before him. With their guns and their greed, they had undone in a few hours the work of 1,000 years. Those villagers they had not herded away, they had slaughtered. Doro found human bones, hair, bits of desiccated flesh missed by scavengers. He stood over a very small skeleton, the bones of a child, and wondered where the survivors had been taken. Which country or New World colony? How far would he have to travel to find the remnants of what had been a healthy, vigorous people? Finally, he stumbled away from the ruins bitterly angry, not knowing or caring where he went. It was a matter of pride with him that he protected his own. Not the individuals, perhaps, but the groups. They gave him their loyalty, their obedience, and he protected them. He had failed. He wandered southwest toward the forest, leaving as he had arrived, alone, unarmed, without supplies, accepting the savannah and later the forest as easily as he accepted any terrain. He was killed several times, by disease, by animals, by hostile people. This was a harsh land. Yet he continued to move southwest, unthinkingly veering away from the section of the coast where his ship awaited him. After a while, he realized it was no longer his anger at the loss of his seed village that drove him. It was something new, an impulse, a feeling, a kind of mental undertow pulling at him. He could have resisted it easily, but he did not. He felt there was something for him farther on, a little farther, just ahead. He trusted such feelings. He had not been this far west for several hundred years. Thus he could be certain that whatever, whoever he found, would be new to him, new and potentially valuable. He moved on eagerly. The feeling became sharper and finer, resolving itself into a kind of signal he would normally have expected to receive only from people he knew, people like his lost villagers whom he should be tracking now before they were forced to mix their seed with foreigners and breed away all the special qualities he valued in them. But he continued on southwest, closing slowly on his quarry. Anyanwu's ears and eyes were far sharper than those of other people. She had increased their sensitivity deliberately after the first time men came stalking her, their machetes ready, their intentions clear. She had had to kill 7 times on that terrible day. 7 frightened men who could have been spared, and she had nearly died herself, all because she let people come upon her unnoticed. Never again. Now, for instance, she was very much aware of the lone intruder who prowled the bush near her. He kept himself hidden, moved toward her like smoke, but she heard him, followed him with her ears. Giving no outward sign, she went on tending her garden. As long as she knew where the intruder was, she had no fear of him. Perhaps he would lose his courage and go away. Meanwhile, there were weeds among her cocoa yams and her herbs. The herbs were not the traditional ones grown or gathered by her people, only she grew them as medicines for healing. Used them when people brought their sick to her. Often she needed no medicines, but she kept that to herself. She served her people by giving them relief from pain and sickness. Also, she enriched them by allowing them to spread word of her abilities to neighboring people. She was an oracle, a woman through whom a god spoke. Strangers paid heavily for her services. They paid her people, then they paid her. That was as it should have been. Her people could see that they benefited from her presence, and that they had reason to fear her abilities. Thus was she protected from them, and they from her, most of the time. But now and then one of them overcame his fear and found reason to try to end her long life. The intruder was moving close, still not allowing her to see him. No person of honest intentions would approach so stealthily. Who was he then? A thief? A murderer? Someone who blamed her for the death of a kinsman or some other misfortune? During her various youths, she had been blamed several times for causing misfortune. She had been fed poison in the test for witchcraft. Each time, she had taken the test willingly, knowing that she had bewitched no one, and knowing that no ordinary man with his scanty knowledge of poisons could harm her. She knew more about poisons, had ingested more poisons in her long life than any of her people could imagine. Each time she passed the test, her accusers had been ridiculed and fined for their false charges. In each of her lives, as she grew older, people ceased to accuse her, though not all ceased to believe she was a witch. Some sought to take matters into their own hands and kill her regardless of the tests. The intruder finally moved onto the narrow path to approach her openly, now that he had enough of spying on her. She looked up as though becoming aware of him for the first time. He was a stranger, a fine man taller than most, and broader at the shoulders. His skin was as dark as her own, and his face was broad and handsome, the mouth slightly smiling. He was young, not yet 30, she thought. Surely too young to be any threat to her. Yet something about him worried her. His sudden openness after so much stealth, perhaps. Who was he? What did he want? When he was near enough, he spoke to her, and his words made her frown in confusion. They were foreign words, completely incomprehensible to her, but there was a strange familiarity to them, as though she should have understood. She stood up, concealing uncharacteristic nervousness.
"Who are you?"
she asked. He lifted his head slightly as she spoke, seemed to listen.
"How can we speak?"
she asked.
"You must be from very far away if your speech is so different."
"Very far," he said in her own language. His words were clear to her now, though he had an accent that reminded her of the way people spoke long ago when she was truly young. She did not like it. Everything about him made her uneasy.
"So you can speak," she said.
"I am remembering. It has been a long time since I spoke your language."
He came closer, peering at her. Finally he smiled and shook his head.
"You are something more than an old woman," he said. "Perhaps you are not an old woman at all."
She drew back in confusion. How could he know anything of what she was? How could he even guess with nothing more than her appearance and a few words as evidence?
"I am old," she said, masking her fear with anger.
"I could be your mother's mother."
She could have been an ancestor of his mother's mother, but she kept that to herself.
"Who are you?"
she demanded.
"I could be your mother's father," he said.
She took another step backward, somehow controlling her growing fear. This man was not what he seemed to be. His words should have come to her as mocking nonsense, but instead they seemed to reveal as much and as little as her own.
"Be still," he told her.
"I mean you no harm."
"Who are you?"
she repeated.
"Doro."
"Doro?"
she said the strange word twice more.
"Is that a name?"
"It is my name. Among my people it means the east, the direction from which the sun comes."
She put one hand to her face.
"This is a trick,"
she said.
"Someone is laughing."
"You know better,"
When were you last frightened by a trick?
Not for more years than she could remember. He was right. But the names, the coincidence was like a sign.
Do you know who I am?
She asked.
Did you come here knowing her?
I came here because of you. I knew nothing about you except that you are unusual, and you are here. Awareness of you has pulled me a great distance out of my way.
Awareness?
I had a feeling. People as different as you attract me somehow, call me, even over great distances.
I did not call you.
You exist, and you are different. That was enough to attract me. Now tell me who you are.
You must be the only man in this country who has not heard of me. I am Anyanwu.
He repeated her name and glanced upward, understanding. Sun, her name meant. Anyanwu, the sun. He nodded.
Our peoples missed each other by many years and a great distance, Anyanwu, and yet somehow they named us well.
As though we were intended to meet. Doro, who are your people?
They were called Kush in my time. Their land is far to the east of here. I was born to them, but they have not been my people for many years. I have not seen them for perhaps 12 times as long as you have been alive. When I was 13 years old, I was separated from them. Now my people are those who give me their loyalty.
And now you think you know my age, she said. That is something my own people do not know.
No doubt you have moved from town to town to help them forget.
He looked around, saw a fallen tree nearby. He went to sit on it. Anyanwu followed, almost against her will. As much as this man confused and frightened her, he also intrigued her. It had been so long since something had happened to her that had not happened before, many times before. He spoke again.
I do nothing to conceal my age, he said. Yet some of my people have found it more comfortable to forget, since they can neither kill me nor become what I am.
She went closer to him and peered down at him. He was clearly proclaiming himself like her, long-lived and powerful. In all her years, she had not known even one other person like herself. She had long ago given up, accepted her solitude. But now...
Go on talking, she said. You have much to tell me.
He had been watching her, looking at her eyes with a curiosity that most people tried to hide from her. People said her eyes were like baby's eyes, the whites too white, the browns too deep and clear. No adult, and certainly no old woman, should have such eyes, they said. And they avoided her gaze. Doro's eyes were very ordinary, but he could stare at her as children stared. He had no fear, and probably no shame. He startled her by taking her hand and pulling her down beside him on the tree trunk. She could have broken his grip easily, but she did not.
I've come a long way today, he told her. This body needs rest if it is to continue to serve me.
She thought about that. This body needs rest. What a strange way he had of speaking.
I came to this territory last about 300 years ago, he said. I was looking for a group of my people who had strayed, but they were killed before I found them. Your people were not here then, and you had not been born. I know that because your difference did not call me. I think you are the fruit of my people's passing by yours, though.
Do you mean that your people may be my kinsmen?
Yes.
He was examining her face very carefully, perhaps seeking some resemblance. He would not find it. The face she was wearing was not her true face.
Your people have crossed the Niger.
He hesitated, frowning, then gave the river its proper name. The Oromili.
When I saw them last, they lived on the other side in Benin.
We crossed long ago,
she said. Children born in that time have grown old and died. We were Ado and Idu, subject to Benin before the crossing. Then we fought with Benin and crossed the river to Onitsha to become free people, our own masters.
What happened to the Oze people who were here before you?
Some ran away. Others became our slaves.
So you were driven from Benin, then you drove others from here, or enslaved them.
Anyanwu looked away, spoke woodenly.
It is better to be a master than to be a slave.
Her husband at the time of the migration had said that. He had seen himself becoming a great man, master of a large household with many wives, children, and slaves. Anyanwu, on the other hand, had been a slave twice in her life and had escaped only by changing her identity completely and finding a husband in a different town. She knew some people were masters and some were slaves. That was the way it had always been. But her own experience had taught her to hate slavery. She had even found it difficult to be a good wife in her most recent years because of the way a woman must bow her head and be subject to her husband. It was better to be as she was, a priestess who spoke with the voice of a god and was feared and obeyed. But what was that? She had become a kind of master herself.
Sometimes one must become a master to avoid becoming a slave,
she said softly. Yes, he agreed. She deliberately turned her attention to the new things he had given her to think about. Her age, for instance. He was right. She was about 300 years old, something none of her people would have believed, and he had said something else, something that brought alive one of her oldest memories. There had been whispers when she was a girl that her father could not beget children, that she was the daughter not only of another man, but of a visiting stranger. She had asked her mother about this, and for the first and only time in her life, her mother had struck her. From then on, she had accepted the story as true. But she had never been able to learn anything about the stranger. She would not have cared. Her mother's husband claimed her as his daughter, and he was a good man. But she had always wondered whether the stranger's people were more like her.
Are they all dead?
She asked Doro.
These kinsmen of mine?
Yes.
Then they were not like me.
They might have been after many more generations. You are not only their child. Your Onitsha kinsmen must have been unusual in their own right.
Anyanwu nodded slowly. She could think of several unusual things about her mother. The woman had stature and influence, in spite of the gossip about her. Her husband was a member of a highly respected clan, well known for its magical abilities. But in his household, it was Anyanwu's mother who made magic. She had highly accurate prophetic dreams. She made medicine to cure disease and to protect the people from evil. At market, no woman was a better trader. She seemed to know just how to bargain, as though she could read the thoughts in the other women's minds. She became very wealthy. It was said that Anyanwu's clan, the clan of her mother's husband, had members who could change their shapes, take animal forms at will, but Anyanwu had seen no such strangeness in them. It was her mother in whom she found strangeness, closeness, empathy that went beyond what could be expected between mother and daughter. She and her mother had shared a unity of spirit that actually did involve some exchange of thoughts and feelings, though they were careful not to flaunt this before others. If Anyanwu felt pain, her mother, busy trading at some distant market, knew of the pain and came home. Anyanwu had no more than ghosts of that early closeness with her own children and with three of her husbands. And she had sought for years through her clan, her mother's clan, and others for even a ghost of her greatest difference, the shape-changing. She had collected many frightening stories, but had met no other person who, like herself, could demonstrate this ability. Not until now, perhaps. She looked at Doro. What was it she felt about him? What strangeness? She had shared no thoughts with him, but Something about him reminded her of her mother. Another ghost.
Are you my kinsman?
She asked. No, he said. But your kinsmen had given me their loyalty. That is no small thing.
Is that why you came when my difference attracted you?
He shook his head. I came to see what you were. She frowned, suddenly cautious.
I am myself. You see me?
As you see me. Do you imagine you see everything? She did not answer. A lie offends me, Anyanwu, and what I see of you is a lie. Show me what you really are.
You see what you will see.
Are you afraid to show me?
No.
It was not fear. What was it? A lifetime of concealment, of commanding herself never to play with her abilities before others, never to show them off as mere tricks, never to let her people or any people know the full extent of her power unless she were fighting for her life? Should she break her tradition now simply because this stranger asked her to? He had done much talking, but what had he actually shown her about himself? Nothing.
Can my concealment be a lie if yours is not?
She asked. Mine is, he admitted.
Then show me what you are. Give me the trust you asked me to give you.
You have my trust, Anyanwu, but knowing what I am would only frighten you.
Am I a child, then?
She asked angrily.
Are you my mother who must shield me from adult truths?
He refused to be insulted. Most of my people are grateful to me for shielding them from my particular truth, he said.
So you say. I have seen nothing.
He stood up, and she stood to face him, her small, withered body fully in the shadow of his. She was little more than half his size, but it was no new thing for her to face larger people and either bend them to her will with words or beat them into submission physically. In fact, she could have made herself as large as any man, but she chose to let her smallness go on deceiving people. Most often, it put strangers at their ease because she seemed harmless. Also, it caused would-be attackers to underestimate her. Doro stared down at her. Sometimes only a burn will teach a child to respect fire, he said. Come with me to one of the villages of your town, Anyanwu. There I will show you what you think you want to see.
What will you do?
She asked warily. I will let you choose someone, an enemy or only some useless person that your people would be better without. Then I will kill him.
Kill?
I kill Anyanwu. That is how I keep my youth, my strength. I can do only one thing to show you what I am, and that is kill a man and wear his body like a cloth. He breathed deeply. This is not the body I was born into. It's not the 10th I've worn, nor the 100th, nor the 1,000th. Your gift seems to be a gentle one. Mine is not.
You are a spirit,
she cried in alarm. I told you you were a child, he said. See how you frighten yourself? He was like an Ogbanje. An evil child spirit born to one woman again and again, only to die and give the mother pain. A woman tormented by an Ogbanje could give birth many times and still have no living child. But Doro was an adult. He did not enter and re-enter his mother's womb. He did not want the bodies of children. He preferred to steal the bodies of men.
You are a spirit,
she insisted, her voice shrill with fear. All the while, part of her mind wondered why she was believing him so easily. She knew many tricks herself, many frightening lies. Why should she react now like the most ignorant stranger brought before her, believing that a god spoke through her? Yet she did believe, and she was afraid. This man was far more unusual than she was. This man was not a man. When he touched her arm lightly, unexpectedly, she screamed. He made a sound of disgust.
Woman, if you bring your people here with your noise, I will have no choice but to kill some of them.
She stood still, believing this also.
Did you kill anyone as you came here?
She whispered.
No. I went to great trouble to avoid killing for your sake. I thought you might have kinsmen here.
Generations of kinsmen. Sons and their sons and even their sons.
I would not want to kill one of your sons.
Why?
She was relieved, but curious.
What are they to you?
How would you receive me if I came to you clothed in the flesh of one of your sons?
She drew back, not knowing how to imagine such a thing.
You see, your children should not be wasted anyway. They may be good.
He spoke a word in another language. She heard it clearly, but it meant nothing to her. The word was seed.
What is seed?
She asked. People too valuable to be casually killed, he said. Then more softly, you must show me what you are.
How can my sons be of value to you?
He gave her a long, silent look, then spoke with that same softness.
I may have to go to them, Anyanwu. They may be more tractable than their mother.
She could not recall ever having been threatened so gently or so effectively. Her sons.
Come,
she whispered.
It is too open for me to show you here.
With concealed excitement, Doro followed the small, wizened woman to her tiny compound. The compound wall, made of red clay and over 6 feet high, would give them the privacy Anyanwu wanted.
My sons would do you no good,
she told him as they walked.
They are good men, but they know very little.
They are not like you, any of them?
None.
And your daughters?
Nor them. I watched them carefully until they went away to their husbands' towns. They are like my mother. They exert great influence on their husbands and on other women, but nothing beyond that. They live their lives and they die.
They die?
She opened the wooden door and led him through the wall, then barred the door after him.
They die,
she said sadly.
Like their fathers.
Perhaps if your sons and daughters married each other...
Abomination!
She said with alarm.
We are not animals here, Doro.
He shrugged. He had spent most of his life ignoring such protests and causing the protesters to change their minds. People's morals rarely survived confrontations with him. For now, though, gentleness. This woman was valuable. If she were only half as old as he thought, she would be the oldest person he had ever met, and she was still spry. She was descended from people whose abnormally long lives, resistance to disease, and budding special abilities made them very important to him. People who, like so many others, had fallen victim to slavers or tribal enemies. There had been so few of them. Nothing must happen to this one survivor, this fortunate little hybrid. Above all, she must be protected from Doro himself. He must not kill her out of anger or by accident. And accidents could happen so easily in this country. He must take her away with him to one of his more secure seed towns. Perhaps in her strangeness she could still bear young, and perhaps with the powerful mates he could get her, this time her children would be worthy of her. If not, there were always her existing children.
Will you watch, Doro?
She asked.
This is what you demanded to see.
He focused his attention on her, and she began to rub her hands. The hands were bird claws, long-fingered, withered, and bony. As he watched, they began to fill out, to grow smooth and young-looking. Her arms and shoulders began to fill out, and her sagging breasts drew themselves up round and high. Her hips grew round beneath her cloth, causing him to want to strip the cloth from her. Lastly, she touched her face and molded away her wrinkles. An old scar beneath one eye vanished. The flesh became smooth and firm, and the woman startlingly beautiful. Finally, she stood before him looking not yet 20. She cleared her throat and spoke to him in a soft, young woman's voice.
"Is this enough?"
For a moment, he could only stare at her. "Is this truly you, Anyanwu?"
"As I am, as I would always be if I did not age or change myself for others. This shape flows back to me very easily. Others are harder to take."
"Others? Did you think I could take only one?" She began molding her malleable body into another shape.
"I took animal shapes to frighten my people when they wanted to kill me," she said. "I became a leopard and spat at them. They believe in such things, but they do not like to see them proved. Then I became a sacred python, and no one dared to harm me. The python shape brought me luck. We were needing rain then to save the yam crop, and while I was a python, the rains came. The people decided my magic was good, and it took them a long time to want to kill me again."
She was becoming a small, well-muscled man as she spoke. Now Doro did try to strip away her cloth, moving slowly so that she would understand. He felt her strength for a moment when she caught his hand and, with no special effort, almost broke it. Then, as he controlled his surprise, prevented himself from reacting to the pain, she untied her cloth herself and took it off. For several seconds, he was more impressed with that casual grip than with her body. But he could not help noticing that she had become thoroughly male.
"Could you father a child?" he asked.
"In time. Not now."
"Have you?"
"Yes, but only girl children."
He shook his head, laughing. The woman was far beyond anything he had imagined.
"I'm surprised your people have let you live," he said. "Do you think I would let them kill me?" she asked.
He laughed again.
"What will you do then, Anyanwu? Stay here with them, convincing each new generation that you are best left alone? Or will you come with me?"
She tied her cloth around her again, then stared at him, her large, too clear eyes looking deceptively gentle in her young man's face.
"Is that what you want?"
she asked.
"For me to go with you?"
"Yes."
"That is your true reason for coming here, then?"
He thought he heard fear in her voice, and his throbbing hand convinced him that she must not be unduly frightened. She was too powerful. She might force him to kill her. He spoke honestly.
"I let myself be drawn here because people who had pledged loyalty to me had been taken away in slavery," he said. "I went to their village to get them, take them to a safer home, and I found only what the slavers had left. I went away not caring where my feet took me. When they brought me here, I was surprised, and for the first time in many days, I was pleased."
"It seems your people are often taken from you."
"It does not seem so. It is so. That is why I am gathering them all closer together in a new place. It will be easier for me to protect them there."
"I have always protected myself."
"I can see that. You will be very valuable to me. I think you could protect others as well as yourself."
"Shall I leave my people to help you protect yours?"
"You should leave so that you finally can be with your own kind.
With one who kills men and shrouds himself in their skins, we are not alike, Doro."
Doro sighed, looked over at her house, a small rectangular building whose steeply sloping thatched roof dipped to within a few feet of the ground. Its walls were made of the same red earth as the compound wall. He wondered obscurely whether the red earth was the same clay he had seen in Indian dwellings in southwestern parts of the North American continent. But more immediately, he wondered whether there were couches in Anyanwu's house, and food and water. He was almost too tired and hungry to go on arguing with the woman.
"Give me food, Anyanwu," he said. "Then I will have the strength to entice you away from this place."
She looked startled, then laughed, almost reluctantly. It occurred to him that she did not want him to stay and eat, did not want him to stay at all. She believed the things he had told her, and she feared that he could entice her away. She wanted him to leave, or part of her did. Surely there was another part that was intrigued, that wondered what would happen if she left her home, walked away with this stranger. She was too alert, too alive, not to have the kind of mind that probed and reached and got her into trouble now and then.
"A bit of yam, at least, Anyanwu," he said, smiling. "I have eaten nothing today."
He knew she would feed him. Without a word, she walked away to another smaller building and returned with two large yams. Then she led him into her kitchen and gave him a deerskin to sit on, since he carried nothing other than the cloth around his loins. Still in her male guise, she courteously shared a kola nut and a little palm wine with him. Then she began to prepare food. Besides the yams, she had vegetables, smoked fish, and palm oil. She built up a fire from the live coals in the tripod of stones that formed her hearth, then put a clay pot of water on to boil. She began to peel the yams. She would cut them up and boil the pieces until they were tender enough to be pounded, as her people liked them. Perhaps she would make soup of the vegetables, oil, and fish, but that would take time.
"What do you do?"
she asked him as she worked.
"Steal food when you are hungry?"
"Yes," he said. He stole more than food. If there were no people he knew near him, or if he went to people he knew and they did not welcome him, he simply took a new, strong, young body. No person, no group could stop him from doing this. No one could stop him from doing anything at all.
"A thief,"
said Anyanwu with disgust that he did not think was quite real.
"You steal, you kill. What else do you do?"
"I build," he said quietly. "I search the land for people who are a little different, or very different. I search them out, I bring them together in groups, I begin to build them into a strong new people."
She stared at him in surprise.
"They let you do this? That you take them from their people, their families?"
"Some bring their families with them. Many do not have families. Their differences have made them outcasts. They are glad to follow me."
"Always?"
"Often enough," he said.
"What happens when people will not follow you? What happens if they say, 'It seems too many of your people are dying, Doro. We will stay where we are and live'?"
He got up and went to the doorway of the next room, where two hard but inviting clay couches had been built out from the walls. He had to sleep. In spite of the youth and strength of the body he was wearing, it was only an ordinary body. If he were careful with it, gave it proper rest and food, did not allow it to be injured, it would last him a few more weeks. If he drove it, though, as he had been driving it to reach Anyanwu, he would use it up much sooner. He held his hands before him, palms down, and was not surprised to see that they were shaking.
"Anyanwu, I must sleep. Wake me when the food is ready."
"Wait!"
The sharpness of her voice stopped him, made him look back.
"Answer,"
she said.
"What happens when people will not follow you?"
Was that all? He ignored her, climbed onto one of the couches, lay down on the mat that covered it, and closed his eyes. He thought he heard her come into the room and go out again before he drifted off to sleep, but he paid no attention. He had long ago discovered that people were much more cooperative if he made them answer questions like hers for themselves. Only the stupid actually needed to hear his answer, and this woman was not stupid. When she woke him, the house was full of the odor of food, and he got up alert and ravenous. He sat with her, washed his hands absently in the bowl of water she gave him, then used his fingers to scoop up a bit of pounded yam from his platter and dip it into the common pot of peppery soup. The food was good and filling, and for some time he concentrated on it, ignoring Anyanwu, except to notice that she was also eating and did not seem inclined to talk. He recalled, distantly, that there had been some small religious ceremony between the washing of hands and the eating when he had last been with her people. An offering of food and palm wine to the gods. He asked about it once he had taken the edge off his hunger. She glanced at him.
What gods do you respect?
None.
And why not?
I help myself, he said. She nodded.
In at least two ways you do. I help myself too.
He smiled a little, but could not help wondering how hard it might be to tame even partially a wild seed woman who had been helping herself for 300 years. It would not be hard to make her follow him. She had sons, and she cared for them. Thus, she was vulnerable. But she might very well make him regret taking her, especially since she was too valuable to kill if he could possibly spare her.
For my people, she said. I respect the gods. I speak as the voice of a god. For myself, in my years, I have seen that people must be their own gods and make their own good fortune. The bad will come or not come anyway.
You are very much out of place here, she sighed.
Everything comes back to that. I am content here, Doro. I have already had 10 husbands to tell me what to do. Why should I make you the 11th? Because you will kill me if I refuse? Is that how men get wives in your homeland? By threatening murder? Well, perhaps you cannot kill me. Perhaps we should find out.
He ignored her outburst, noticed instead that she had automatically assumed that he wanted her as his wife. That was a natural assumption for her to make, perhaps a correct assumption. He had been asking himself which of his people she should be mated with first, but now he knew he would take her himself, for a while at least. He often kept the most powerful of his people with him for a few months, perhaps a year. If they were children, they learned to accept him as father. If they were men, they learned to obey him as master. If they were women, they accepted him best as lover or husband. Anyanwu was one of the handsomest women he had ever seen. He had intended to take her to bed this night, and many more nights, until he got her to the seed village he was assembling in the British-ruled colony of New York. But why should that be enough? The woman was a rare find. He spoke softly.
Shall I try to kill you then, Anyanwu?
Why? Would you kill me if you could? Perhaps I can.
Here I am.
He looked at her with eyes that ignored the male form she still wore, eyes that spoke to the woman inside, or he hoped they did. It would be much more pleasant to have her come to him because she wanted to, rather than because she was afraid. She said nothing, as though his mildness confused her. He had intended it to.
We would be right together, Anyanwu. Have you never wanted a husband who was worthy of you?
You think very much of yourself.
And of you. Or why would I be here?
I have had husbands who were great men, she said. Titled men of proven courage, even though they had no special abilities such as yours. I have sons who are priests, wealthy sons, men of standing. Why should I want a husband who must prey on other men like a wild beast?
He touched his chest.
This man came to prey on me. He attacked me with a machete.
That stopped her for a moment. She shuddered.
I have been cut that way. Cut almost in half. What did you do?
I healed myself. I would not have thought I could heal so quickly.
I mean, what did you do to the man who cut you?
Men. 7 of them came to kill me.
What did you do, Anyanwu? She seemed to shrink into herself at the memory.
I killed them, she whispered. To warn others and because I was angry.
Doro sat watching her, seeing remembered pain in her eyes. He could not recall the last time he had felt pain at killing a man. Anger, perhaps, when a man of power and potential became arrogant and had to be destroyed. Anger at the waste. But not pain.
You see, he said softly. How did you kill them?
With my hands.
She spread them before her. Ordinary hands now, not even remarkably ugly as they had been when she was an old woman.
I was angry, she repeated. I have been careful not to get too angry since then.
But what did you do?
Why do you want to know all the shameful details? She demanded. I killed them. They are dead. They were my people, and I killed them.
How can it be shameful to kill those who would have killed you?
She said nothing.
Surely those 7 are not the only ones you've killed.
She sighed, stared into the fire.
I frighten them when I can. Kill only when they make me. Most often, they are already afraid and easy to drive away. I am making the ones here reach so that none of them have wanted me dead for years.
Tell me how you killed the 7.
She got up and went outside. It was dark out now, deep, moonless darkness, but Doro did not doubt that Anyanwu could see with those eyes of hers. Where had she gone, though, and why? She came back, sat down again, and handed him a rock.
Break it, she said tonelessly.
It was a rock, not hardened mud, and though he might have broken it with another rock or a metal tool, he could make no impression on it with his hands. He returned it to her, whole. And she crushed it in one hand. He had to have the woman. She was wild seed of the best kind. She would strengthen any line he bred her into, strengthen it immeasurably.
Come with me, Anyanwu. You belong with me, with the people I'm gathering. We are people you can be part of, people you need not frighten or bribe into letting you live.
I was born among these people, she said. I belong with them.
And she insisted.
You and I are not alike.
We are more like each other than like other people. We need not hide from each other.
He looked at her muscular young man's body. Become a woman again, Anyanwu, and I will show you that we should be together. She managed a wan smile.
I have borne 47 children to 10 husbands, she said. What do you think you can show me?
If you come with me, I think someday I can show you children you will never have to bury.
He paused, saw that he now had her full attention.
A mother should not have to watch her children grow old and die, he continued. If you leave, they should leave. It is the fault of their fathers that they die. Let me give you children who will live.
She put her hands to her face, and for a moment he thought she was crying. But her eyes were dry when she looked at him.
Children? From your stolen loins? She whispered.
Not these loins.
He gestured toward his body.
This man was only a man, but I promise you, if you come with me, I will give you children of your own kind.
There was a long silence. She sat staring into the fire again, perhaps making up her mind. Finally, she looked at him, studied him with such intensity he began to feel uncomfortable. His discomfort amazed him. He was more accustomed to making other people uncomfortable. And he did not like her appraising stare, as though she were deciding whether or not to buy him. If he could win her alive, he would teach her manners someday. It was not until she began to grow breasts that he knew for certain he had won. He got up then, and when the change was complete, he took her to the couch. Chapter 2. They arose before dawn the next day. Anyanwu gave Doro a machete and took one for herself. She seemed content as she put a few of her belongings into a long basket to be carried with her. Now that she had made her decision, she expressed no more doubts about leaving with him, though she was concerned for her people.
"You must let me guide you past the villages," she told him.
She again wore the guise of a young man and had twisted her cloth around her and between her legs in the way of a man.
"There are villages all around me here so that no stranger can reach me without paying. You were fortunate to reach me without being stopped. Or perhaps my people were fortunate. I must see that they are fortunate again."
He nodded. As long as she kept him going in the right direction, she could lead as long as she wanted to. She had given him pounded yam from the night before to break his fast, and during the night she had managed to exhaust his strong, young body with lovemaking.
"You are a good man,"
she had observed contentedly,
"and it has been too long since I had this."
He was surprised to realize how much her small compliment pleased him, how much the woman herself pleased him. She was a worthwhile find in many ways. He watched her take a last look at her house, left swept and neat, at her compound, airy and pleasant in spite of its smallness. He wondered how many years this had been her home.
"My sons helped me build this place," she told him softly. "I told them I needed a place apart where I could be free to make my medicines. All but one of them came to help me. That one was my oldest living son, who said I must live in his compound. He was surprised when I ignored him. He is wealthy and arrogant, and used to being listened to, even when what he says is nonsense, as it often is. He did not understand anything about me, so I showed him a little of what I have shown you. Only a little. It closed his mouth."
"It would," laughed Doro.
"He is a very old man now. I think he is the only one of my sons who will not miss me. He will be glad to find me gone, like some others of my people, even though I have made them rich. Few of them living now are old enough to remember my great changes here, from woman to leopard to python. They have only their legends and their fear."
She got two yams and put them into her basket, then got several more and threw them to her goats, who scrambled first to escape them, then to get them.
"They have never eaten so well," she said, laughing.
Then she sobered, went to a small shelter where clay figurines representing gods sat.
"This is for my people to see," she told Doro. "This and the ones inside."
She gestured toward her house.
"I did not see any inside."
Her eyes seemed to smile through her somber expression.
"You almost sat on them."
Startled, he thought back. He usually tried not to outrage people's religious beliefs too quickly, though Anyanwu did not seem to have many religious beliefs. But to think he had come near to sitting on religious objects without recognizing them.
"Do you mean those clay lumps in the corner?"
"Those," she said simply. "My mother's."
Symbols of ancestral spirits, he remembered now. He shook his head.
"I am getting careless," he said in English.
"What are you saying?"
"That I am sorry. I have been away from your people too long."
"It does not matter. As I said, these things are for others to see. I must lie a little, even here."
"No more," he said.
"This town will think I am finally dead,"
she said, staring at the figurines.
Perhaps they will make a shrine and give it my name. Other towns have done that. Then at night, when they see shadows and branches blowing in the wind, they can tell each other they have seen my spirit.
A shrine with spirits will frighten them less than the living woman, I think, Doro said. Not quite smiling, Anyanwu led him through the compound door, and they began the long trek over a maze of footpaths so narrow that they could walk only in single file between the tall trees. Anyanwu carried her basket on her head, and her machete sheathed at her side. Her bare feet and Doro's made almost no sound on the path, nothing to confuse Anyanwu's sensitive ears. Several times as they moved along at the pace, she said, a swift walk, she turned aside and slipped silently into the bush. Doro followed with equal skill, and always shortly afterward, people passed by. There were women and children bearing water pots or firewood on their heads. There were men carrying hoes and machetes. It was as Anyanwu had said. They were in the middle of her town, surrounded by villages. No European would have recognized the town, however, since most of the time there were no dwellings in sight. But on his way to her, Doro had stumbled across the villages, across one large compound after another, and either slipped past them or walked past boldly, as though he had legitimate business. Fortunately, no one had challenged him. People often hesitated to challenge a man who seemed important and purposeful. They would not, however, have hesitated to challenge strangers who hid themselves, who appeared to be spying. As Doro followed Anyanwu now, he worried that he still might wind up wearing the body of one of her kinsmen and having great trouble with her. He was relieved when she told him they had left her people's territory behind. At first, Anyanwu was able to lead Doro along already cleared paths through territory she knew either because she had once lived in it or because her daughters lived in it now. Once, as they walked, she was telling him about a daughter who had married a handsome, strong, lazy young man, then run away to a much less imposing man who had some ambition. He listened for a while, then asked, "How many of your children live to adulthood, Anyanwu?"
"Every one," she said proudly. "They were all strong and well and had no forbidden things wrong with them."
Children with forbidden things wrong with them, twins, for instance, and children born feet first, children with almost any deformity, children born with teeth. These children were thrown away. Doro had gotten some of his best stock from earlier cultures who, for one reason or another, put infants out to die.
"You had 47 children," he said in disbelief. "And all of them lived and were perfect?" "Perfect in their bodies, at least. They all survived." "They are my people's children. Perhaps some of them and their descendants should come with us after all."
Anyanwu stopped so suddenly that he almost ran into her.
"You will not trouble my children," she said quietly.
He stared down at her. She had still not bothered to make herself taller, though she told him she could, and tried to swallow sudden anger. She spoke to him as though he were one of her children. She did not yet understand his power.
"I am here," she said in the same quiet voice. "You have me."
"Do I?"
"As much as any man could."
That stopped him. There was no challenge in her voice, but he realized at once she was not telling him she was all his property. She was saying only that he had whatever small part of herself she reserved for her men. She was not used to men who could demand more. Though she came from a culture in which wives literally belonged to their husbands, she had power, and her power had made her independent, accustomed to being her own person. She did not yet realize that she had walked away from that independence when she walked away from her people with him.
"Let's go on," he said.
But she did not move.
"You have something to tell me," she said. He sighed. "Your children are safe, Anyanwu.
For the moment. She turned and led on. Doro followed, thinking that he had better get her with a new child as quickly as he could. Her independence would vanish without a struggle. She would do whatever he asked then,